Senate Judiciary and Public Safety Committee will come to order. For the record, today's date is April 5th, 2011. The first bill is Senator Hall, Senate File Number 882, Required Fingerprinting Provisions. Senator Hall, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I do have Senate File 882, a bill which reinstates the violation of a domestic abuse no-contact order as a targeted misdemeanor for which fingerprinting is required. And I have with me a testifier from the Bureau, Katie Engler, who will explain this a little bit more.
Welcome to the committee.
Mr. Chair, for the record, my name is Katie Engler. I'm with the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension. Just by way of background, the Bureau maintains a statewide criminal history repository that contains information about felonies, gross misdemeanors, and what have become a defined term, targeted misdemeanors. And that term was first used in 1997, and at that time included a reference to Minnesota Statute Section 518B.01, which at the time covered orders for protection. In 2000, domestic abuse no-contact orders were added to that provision in Chapter 518B. Last year, the legislature did what's called a recodification of the domestic abuse no-contact order language and moved the provisions related to that type of action into Section 629.75. The bill last year included a revisor's instruction to correct statutory references and other provisions of law. Unfortunately, because of the way the language is written related to the statewide criminal history repository and the collection of fingerprints, the revisor was not able to correct the statutory reference. So up until last year, domestic abuse no contact order violations were included in the definition of targeted misdemeanors. What we're asking today with this bill is that, in essence, they be returned to the definition by correcting the statutory reference. We have support from the Minnesota Coalition for Battered Women and the Minnesota County Attorneys Association for the change. I also have permission from the Minnesota Sentencing Guidelines Commission to indicate that while they have no official position on the bill, that it is consistent with their criminal history policy and their understanding that a violation of a domestic abuse no-contact order should be a targeted misdemeanor for which fingerprints are collected in the statewide repository. And with that, I'll be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Ms. Engler. Let the record show that the committee has a quorum at this time. Any questions? Senator Newman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ms. Engler or Senator Hall, are either of you aware of any opposition to this bill?
I'm not.
Mr. Chair, Senator Newman, we are not aware of any opposition.
Senator Newman, anything else? Any other questions? Senator Harrington.
Mr. Chair, Ms. Engler, this is cleaning it. Will this clean up some of the other issues in the Danko order piece in terms of the hearings, or is this just going to take care of the issue around the fingerprints?
Ms. Engler?
Mr. Chair, Senator Harrington, this will just take care of the fingerprints.
Thank you.
All right. Any further questions? Senator Hall, you renew, or Senator Hall moves that Senate File 882 be recommended to pass, and if there's no objection, be moved to the consent calendar.
Mr. Chair, I do move that.
All right. All those in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed? Bill is adopted. Senator Perry, Senate File 1044. Senator Perry, we require that you move just as quickly as Senator Hall did on his bill.
Mr. Chairman, I'm planning on that.
Anytime you are, Senator Perry.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee. It's good to be here in front of you today after a long floor session. With me, I have Wade Setter, Deputy Director of Homeland Security and Emergency Management Division of DPS. What we are here today on is Senate File Number 1044. And let me just give you a real quick background. I was quite involved here, as were some of the testifiers that we might have today, if so needed. But during the preparation of the 2010 second special session, there were needs of communities identified here in Chapter 12A that were not adequately addressed within this chapter. It was determined that those revisions would be put forth in a joint state agency initiative to be coordinated by the Department of Public Safety, Division of Homeland Security, and Emergency Management. So what I plan to do now, Mr. Chair and committee members, is run through what this bill is doing as we're making these changes to better serve our citizens and communities. The bill makes a number of changes to Minnesota Statutes Chapter 12A, the Natural Disaster State Assistance. Section 1, Subdivision 1, clarifies the use of disaster funds appropriated to the Board of Water and Soil Resources for the Reinvest in Minnesota program, RIM program. Subdivision 2 authorizes the Board to establish a disaster recovery program to fund erosion and sediment control, water quality, and watershed protection projects. As we move on to Subdivision 3, provides that disaster grants made by the Board may be extended for up to 2 years. Section 2 then clarifies how disaster enrollment impact aid is to be calculated by the Department of Education. Section 3 restricts disaster grants from the Minnesota Investment Fund for businesses impacted by a disaster to physical losses only. Section 4 requires an organization receiving forgivable loan from the Minnesota Investment Fund to remain in the local community for a minimum of 5 years from the date of the loan, after which the amount of the loan forgiveness must follow a schedule provided by the Commissioner of Employment and Economic Development for an additional 5 years. Section 5 is a technical amendment properly conforming the statute to Minnesota Housing Finance Agency rules. Section 6 authorizes the Commissioner of Health to waive the 60-day notice required under Minnesota Statute Section 144A.071 regarding the layaway of nursing home beds when a partial or complete evacuation occurs in response to a natural disaster. Section 7 deletes the term substantially damaged regarding Department of Natural Resources buyouts of flood-damaged structures. Federal status or statute defining substantially damaged structures restricts the use of funds for buyouts. Section 8 authorizes the Department of Natural Resources to use disaster appropriations to install and repair flood warning gauges. Section 9 authorizes the Department of Natural Resources to use disaster funds to provide cost share for renovating or removing publicly owned dams in the disaster area. Section 10 authorizes the Commissioner of Public Safety to use disaster appropriations to provide assistance in coordinating long-term recovery activities related to the disaster. And then when we look at Section 11, Subdivisions 1 and 3 are technical amendments clarifying the subdivision titles. Subdivision 2 authorizes the use of funds in the emergency relief account in the Trunk Highway Fund for infrastructure repair, maintenance, and operations related to the disaster. Subdivision 3 authorizes the use of disaster funds for demolition and design cost of roads or bridges damaged by the disaster. And Subdivision 4 requires the Commissioner of Transportation, in consultation with the Commissioner of Public Safety, to clarify agency roles and responsibilities for damage estimates used for developing emergency state appropriations. It's a long list that I've just shared with you, Mr. Chairman and committee, but it is a list that I believe has taken from last the floods of, well, actually this all started back in 2007, and after the floods of 2007 we realized that there were issues with Chapter 12A, and so this is just a ongoing mending and massaging this chapter as was evident in the floods of the fall of last year. of which brought us back into that special session. And at that time, I remember sitting in the governor's office when we were working on that bonding bill, and we were talking specifically about some of the issues that needed to be changed to move forward. And I'd like to thank the agencies that have worked long and hard on this and these adjustments to move us forward. And with that, Mr. Chairman, we would open up for any questions.
Any questions on the bill? Senator Jungbauer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Senator Perry, I guess under Section 7, by taking out this substantially damaged, you kind of touched on it, but then we go back to being able to use the funds to buy out basically any structure, but I don't understand in terms of the definition and the federal definition, would that be any structure that would be like in a floodplain or something where we could, so we don't see this damage to the same units over and over that we've seen in the past, floods or other disasters like that?
Senator Perry, before we go any further, this is a bill that's going to make a number of different stops throughout the committee process. Our jurisdiction really is on Section 10 that's found on page 4. Everything else is kind of in a different area, and we had to start the bill somewhere in the process that we're starting here. But perhaps Senator Perry, for the purposes of a little more background, could you answer Senator Jungbauer's question, and then we'll focus on Section 10.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Jungbauer, substantially damaged has a federal definition which restricts the use of funds for buyouts. In addition, there were several instances of flood warning gauges being damaged by the flood. This will allow the DNR to use an appropriation under this chapter to pay for the repair and not wait until funds would be available in the DNR's biennial appropriation, if that helps at all.
I guess, Mr. Chair and Senator Perry, since it's going to have more stops, if you could get me more information about that, the federal definition and how we're affecting it when we change that statement in Minnesota statute.
Senator Jungbauer, are you on the Environmental and Natural Resource Committee?
No, I'm not.
Mr. Chair. Senator Letts.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. I know that this isn't our jurisdiction, but I've had the same question. We're going to use funds to buy out structures, all structures. I'm not sure that's a disaster response or disaster relief. I think that might be long-term planning to prevent future damage or mitigation. I think that's maybe a little bit different than the topic of this bill. So I've got some real problems, just a little that I know on first glance.
All right.
That provision.
Maybe
Mr.
we can.
Chair, if you want, there might be somebody from the DNR here that could maybe elaborate a little bit on that.
Senator Perry. Is there anyone from the DNR that might be able to elaborate on the discussion? There he is. Welcome to the committee.
Mr. Chairman, I'm John Jasky with the Board of Water and Soil Resources. The DNR is a partner in a lot of these projects. The Board of Water and Soil Resources, and we've worked with the Department of Public Safety on the legislation you see before you. I'll try and answer the question about the item in Section 7, just as an example. I'm sure the DNR will be able to give us more details as the bill moves forward. One example that came out of this last flood in 2010 was we had a large bank failure on a site that left a house at the very top of the 60-foot-high bank undamaged but precariously sitting there ready to fall in. So if you were to say that home was not yet damaged, you couldn't buy it out under the program. You'd have to literally let it collapse, let it be damaged, and then buy it out. That doesn't make sense. So there's a couple of cases like that where we'd want to have some flexibility, I think, and the DNR would be supporting that kind of situation as well. But I understand the concern about opening it up broadly, so maybe we can look at some ideas about how to hone it more carefully to the points you're, I think, calling forward here.
Senator Jungbauer, do you have a question?
Well, Mr. Chair, yeah, that's what I would like to see, because when we open something wide open, I have some issues with that, as opposed to honing it in for specifically that type of example. So I have no problem with that type of example, but I'm scared about taking that verbiage out.
Senator Perry, what other committees are you going to other than environment?
Well, I know environment for sure, but after that, I can't be honest with you. I don't know, Mr. Chair.
All right.
But we, Mr. Chair and Senators, we will get back to you on that.
Thank you.
Thank you, members. Any other questions? Senator Hall?
Thank you, Chair. I just want to know, when does this get enacted before the possible flooding coming up?
Senator Perry?
I would say it's how fast we can get the hearings. I believe it's... Go ahead.
Mr. Chairman? Wade
yeah.
Sutter with Homeland Security and Emergency Management.
Clearly,
it would have to go through the process and be signed by the governor to be in law, but I think the issue for us in terms of the existing flood, if I understood the question, this legislation has historically been used to bridge the gaps where there's unmet needs as a result of not receiving a federal declaration in terms of individual assistance in particular. And so it does not come with an appropriation. So what's been done the two times it's been used historically is in special session, and the legislature would take and look at what federal assistance we received, what MN needs, and then use this to kind of bridge those gaps. So it would have to be as a if it was in effect after or during this disaster that we're currently addressing, we would have to have an appropriation associated with it.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Sutter. Any other further questions? Senator Goodwin?
Mr. Chair, Senator Perry, if there's no enactment date, then it would be that wouldn't be enacted until August 1st, unless there's a different enactment date or unless you have a line that says upon final enactment or approval
passages.
Or whatever passage, whatever. Otherwise, it wouldn't be effective until August 1st.
Mr. Chair and Senator Goodwin, that's a good point. We'll check on that because as I recall, it was enacted on its passage, and so. But I'll make sure that I check.
If this bill passes, is it our understanding that you would want this in full effect in order to be ready for any potential flood damage later this spring?
Mr. Chairman, yes.
This legislation,
these amendments and changes to the existing legislation were really designed as a result of the special session last year in determining some aspects of the law that did not apply as well as they did in 2007. So that would be ideal.
So you may want to consider an enactment date to be immediate, if not sooner. And go from there. Senator Trenbauer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And you said we have jurisdiction over Section 10?
Yes, Section
okay.
10, page
well,
4.
Again, Mr. Chair and Senator Perry, I have issues, I guess, with Section 10 in terms of not giving us a real definition of how we're – it shows us who can qualify for money, but we're not given a definition to what kind of assistance and things, and that kind of, again, opens it up long-term. So I'd like to see in the same vein as a change in Section 7 is kind of getting definitional on the boundaries of what people could apply for in terms of helping out with long-term recovery activities.
Well, Senator Jungbauer, if you look at the line on page 4.4, mm-hmm. it makes reference to an existing section of law, 12A.15, and that's our public safety provision. It allows for a state match for federal assistance, grants for debris removal, and a waiver of contract approval procedures. I think that's between state and federal disaster assistance programs. So if you take the long-term recovery assistance, the language that's found on lines 6 through 9, and apply it to the 12A.15 statute, you'll get a better understanding of what it's the context of what we're working with. Senator Jungbauer.
Well, I get that, Mr. Chair, but whenever we start looking at Ms. Line 4.7, providing technical assistance, that's pretty broad in how it applies and how it can open up things. And I understand there's only certain amounts of money and certain things we're trying to accomplish, but anytime we literally broaden the definition as wide as these two definitions appear to me, I get a little scared on. We have slim funds for recoveries anyway, and I want to make sure that we're focusing the monies on exactly the kind of activities we need those technical assistances and things on.
Senator Perry, do you have any advice or direction of what technical assistance means in Section 10?
Well, I think, as I recall over the course of the last flood that I was involved with throughout my Senate district, there were so many different issues that seemed to be coming forth, and to me this allows for the discussion and the discretion of moving forward in the assistance. I know some of the statements that I recall hearing were that the statute was so tight that they couldn't move forward on certain assistance issues. So, you know, any further than that, at this point, Mr. Chairman, I don't know that I can give you all of the different items that we talked about through this time period, unless Mr. Setter has some further that he might be able to add.
Mr. Chair? One example I can remember from last fall is we had a number of counties where people had significant impacts in terms of loss of property, housing, and so forth, and so they have both short and long-term recovery needs. And in the past, we have had the opportunity to provide with local nonprofits in order to assist people in identifying all of the resources available to them for economic recovery. And the recovery is a long-term process. So using a contractor to come in and help us develop a disaster recovery plan so folks can come in and talk about what their economic situation is, what state programs may be available. And this is, again, typically when there's no federal programs that are directly available as a result of the disaster declaration.
Thank you. Any other questions, Senator Jungbauer?
Mr. Chair, I guess I still, you know, given the statute and what this says, I'd be happy to meet with Senator Perry and some other folks in between, but again, it still doesn't seem to match up in terms of what they're talking about and how it fits into the statute and what I've seen in some of the disaster recovery issues, especially if you look at Subdivision 2 and then you call this Subdivision 2A, one would assume that maybe these grants are for figuring out where to bury debris or something, but it doesn't, I don't know, it just doesn't seem to match up to me in terms of where the statute is and broadens out some things. I want to make sure that we're focused on what it does qualify for, or we come back right to the same issues of what qualifies and what doesn't. I'd read the statute earlier. It didn't make sense to me, and as I'm looking at it again, it even makes less sense to me. So.
Senator Perry, I think some of our members are asking a pretty good question of specifics regarding what kind of assistance to local jurisdictions should be justified. Having said that, I sense that there might be a time of essence element here for this particular bill to pass. However, I think there's the previous question that we talked about earlier, and then the definition of what technical assistance, or on line 9, providing assistance in coordinating long-term recovery activities. I think we'd probably like to know a little bit more about what those might be on a more specific nature. And what I would recommend is that you work with Senator Jungbauer and maybe Senator Latz as this bill progresses. And if there is no definition or a reference to what the technical assistance is, we'll have to pull it back into the committee, and then we'll have to make some definitions for you.
And Mr.
If that's okay.
Mr. Chair, and I understand that. I think my when you think about the disasters that, you know, I've been through in my Senate district from the tornado of last summer, the assistance in working for long term, you know, I just went by on Highway 30 where the tornado came out of Freeborn County into Steele County and took farm after farm and acre after acre of old oak trees. There's still assistance needed almost a year later. And I'm not sure that we can, but though we can try to
to nail down specific assistance for every disaster that hasn't happened. I mean, we can take a look at the past. I think about the floods that we also had. And I remember discussion about, yes, there were dollars for the repair of a dam. I don't know if you remember this, but there were no dollars for the assistance in the design of. And because the design, in fact, was more expensive than the repair of the dam, the tendency is just not to repair it and let something happen down the road. And so I'd be more than happy, and I know the departments will be more than happy to work on this section, but I think we have to be cautious that we can nail it down so tight that there's nothing we can provide when, in fact, we should be.
Yeah. Senator Perry, I would think that the agency that deals in this should at least have some kind of laundry list of what would be technical assistance. It may not cover everything, but at least it would be addressing at least the most common things that, through their experience, they should be able to create a list of. And I know it's every emergency may create its own custom need, but at the same time, it should have some basics that is fairly universal. Senator Jungbauer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Senator Perry, and again, kind of the reason my concern, and I did go visit some of the damaged areas, and I can think of a dam in particular that I looked at, and Lanesboro has a dam that has damage that needs some of that technical assistance, and so I understand that. When you come under this issue, the contracts are not issued in the normal way, and so I can think of some examples, and I don't really, I'll tell you outside of the committee, of abuse in other areas when you make it simpler to provide technical assistance and some of the things that even with taking out a forest, I can think of some things where I think state and federal monies have been abused because of the way the contracts can get approved in a different way than we normally would do it. So that's why I want some parameters, but I understand the idea of not having it so that you know, we want to envision all the problems, but we also want to make sure that somebody's not coming in and grabbing money and designing something else that shouldn't be designed under this kind of disaster relief funds.
Any other questions, Senator Hoffman?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm going to just go along with what Senator Jungbauer said and to Senator Perry. I would like to work with you because, as you know, I come from a district that was, you know, I had a couple of towns that were almost destroyed by tornadoes. And I want clarity because I want to be able to go back to my officials and be able to tell them, well, this is where the state can help us. Because I know we, in one of my communities, they're still dealing with some of the things and they're not sure where they're to get help from. So I would like clarity just so I can give them clarity.
All right.
Mr. Chair, we work on that.
All right.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Latz.
I share the concerns that have been already discussed. And maybe we can get some guidance or some information on what kind of oversight or reporting or follow-up accountability results after funds that are appropriated for disasters get dispersed. Might give us some comfort that at least there's someone from outside the process, maybe after the fact, looking back and saying, well, I think you went a little bit beyond what might have been appropriate here. I mean, we all know there are those who, as bad as a disaster is, will try to take advantage of the massive amounts of money coming in, maybe not as big as necessary, but certainly more than would otherwise be flowing into a community to take care of stuff that pre-existed the disaster, and they can somehow make a tenuous connection to it and say, oh, great, we got some money now. We can repair the lamppost. That's, frankly, we didn't have the money to do before but needed it before the disaster hit. The only other thing I thought of was in terms of process, I know it was the practice of this committee before, and I don't know if you know what your practice would be. I'm getting some hints, I think. When the committee has raised issues in the committee about the particular provisions under this committee's jurisdiction, I think this committee has always tried to solve the problem, fix that issue here before it goes on and gets lost in the volume of the legislative agenda. you know, several committees down the road, because each subsequent committee, they're going to say, well, we don't have to talk about Section 10 in the Environment Committee because we dealt with that back in Judiciary, unless one of us is affirmatively tracking any changes that might be there. It'll be easy for us to lose track of it, and so I think the Judiciary Committee especially has really tried to fix the problems within the jurisdiction here before it goes out, and then we're done with it. Yeah. We start to try to do that to more than one bill a session.
Senator Letts, that's a good observation. We have two choices then. We could either temporarily lay the bill on the table, have it come back someday with the idea that the technical assistance and the other reference to assistance in coordinating long-term recovery activities be filled out a little bit as far as the specifics of what that assistance is, and we could have another hearing on it, or we could move the bill without recommendation to the Environment and Natural Resources. Whatever the committee wants to do, that's up to the committee. Senator Jungbauer, did you have a question?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I guess I'd rather, and if it's up to Senator Perry, but when you move a bill without recommendation, it gives kind of a negative connotation to it, I think. And I think we could do this fairly quickly. And I do apologize. I try to read everything before committee and get some ideas, but I've been a little... My mind has been kind of blanked out for the last week and a half here, and people know why. And but I think I've seen it in other things where it's been a little defined. I don't think it's going to take a lot to to get it where we want it. So,
Mr. Chair,
Sir Perry,
I think what I would rather see you do is lay it on the table. Let us go back with the agencies. I know that they will be able to. We should be able to do some articulation in writing. On this assistance, they better know, because they're hearing it all of the time from the communities that we're trying to help here. And I think we could probably do that in short order and try to get back on your calendar here real quick if we could.
All right. Senator Jungbauer moves that Senate Bill 1044 be laid on the table. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr.
We'll see you
Chair
later.
Committee.
Thank you, Senator Perry. Moving on to Senator Newman's Senate File 881. Welcome to the committee, Senator Newman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members. Senate File 881 is a department bill that has been brought forth specifically at the request of the BCA. And it involves e-charging, which currently is used in some criminal complaints amongst adults. And the issue is whether or not to expand the use of e-charging to include juvenile adjudication petitions, petty misdemeanors, and administrative enforcement of the implied consent law. And I have requested Ms. Katie Engler from the BCA to come in and testify today and give you a review of the bill. The only thing I would bring to your attention is in your packet there is a short article. It's entitled News Release, March 22, 2011, that will give you a little bit of background on this bill. And with that, Mr. Chairman, I would defer to Ms. Engler.
Ms. Engler, welcome back.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, Katie Engler with the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension. Senate File 881 is about a system at the Bureau called e-charging. And by way of background, what this is really it's a way of electronically moving data and documents amongst various players, specifically from law enforcement to prosecution for consideration of charges, from prosecution to courts for filing complaints, and then return when a complaint is accepted at the courts so that the prosecutor and law enforcement know that their case, in fact, has been filed. It eliminates paper. It eliminates redundant data entry and errors that result from those multiple data entries. Instead of officers spending time in a car driving documents from place to place in order to get them signed, it's all moved electronically. And so there's savings both in officer time, gasoline, et cetera. Currently, as indicated, the definition of e-charging is limited to complaints. And it specifically says for charging a person with a crime. Well, the way the language in the statutes is written, crimes only refer to accusations against adults. So part of what the proposed language in lines 2.7 through 2.12 would do would make it possible to use this in the future for petitions against juveniles who are alleged to be delinquent. It opens it up for citations, which are cases where an officer issues a citation to an individual, but it doesn't go to a full complaint with a probable cause statement. As Senator Newman indicated, it would include the administrative forms that are needed at the Driver and Vehicle Services in the Department of Public Safety for actions against driver's licenses. It could eventually even include petty misdemeanors. The idea is to leverage the electronic transmission of these documents to provide savings for the various parties in the process. I understand that in Carver County, which has deployed some of this functionality, they did a study, and in total, with other changes that they would make to how they enter data, they anticipate a savings of $500,000 over 5 years using e-charging. So, I also understand that there are some concerns about data practices issues, and specifically whether or not by using the system, parties, particularly law enforcement and prosecutors, could claim that there is some sort of different data classification for the data that they maintain. It would be the position of the Bureau that Chapter 13 is a statute of general applicability. It applies to the data that are held at law enforcement at the prosecutor. And so data classification does not change just because the participants use this electronic means of moving data amongst themselves. And with that, I'll be happy to answer any questions.
Any questions? Senator Jungman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Ms. Engler. The data practices was one of the issues I was concerned with. And though I like the e-charging, we've been trying to figure out other ways to save time and the redundancy of re-entering everything because of the we already see paperwork that doesn't match up, and that's been an issue in terms of courts if somebody didn't exactly enter the same information. So I like that, but you kind of hit upon something. Are we moving something paperlessly now that does need signatures and doesn't get those signatures? And if it should have a signature, is there a way to put that into the system?
Ms. Engler.
Mr. Chair, Senator Jungbauer, what the statute provides and what the Supreme Court has done in amending the Rules of Criminal Procedure is to provide for electronic signature, and specifically when an officer needs to sign a probable cause statement in a complaint, it's done using a biometric, and there's also an electronic notification of electronic notarization of the signature. So the statute provides for that biometric approval, and the court rules have been changed to accommodate them. So the signatures have been replaced with electronic equivalents.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Engler. In terms of safety and security on these systems, you know, if it's in an officer's vehicle or things, if somebody would take control of that vehicle, are the computers secured in any such way where people couldn't have access to this information? How is that kind of security taken care of?
Ms. Engler.
Mr. Chair, Senator Jungbauer, the officer would no longer drive documents around. with when e-charging is deployed. Rather, it's the push of a button on a computer over a secure network that the Bureau operates that transfers other types of protected data. And so there really isn't a security concern because that network is already in place.
Thank you. Any other questions? Sarah Lantz.
Mr. Chairman, Ms. Engler, could you give an example on line 2.7 of how this service would be used by the law enforcement agencies, prosecutor, or courts in apprehending individuals?
Ms. Engler?
Mr. Chair, Senator Lantz, part of the functionality of e-charging is for the law enforcement officer to put his or her incident data into an electronic system and then move it. So the apprehension piece comes with that interaction with individuals in the course of a traffic stop or other activity.
So, Mr. Chairman.
Yeah, Sir Lantz.
So this is beyond the point at which a charging decision has been made, but it's the input of data in the squad car's mobile data terminal or back at the police station when they're typing up incident reports and so on, and maybe transmitting those reports to other parties as well, transmitting reports perhaps to the county attorney's office or city attorney's office for consideration of charges and those kind of things?
Ms. Engler?
Mr. Chair, Senator Lantz, yes. The system is set up to go from potentially from an officer's squad car with some data entry during after a stop, back to the office for completion of an incident report, then sending that incident report electronically to a prosecutor for consideration of charges. Prosecutors have the ability to say, no, I don't have enough information, send it back to law enforcement for them to start over. Judges as well, once they review a complaint, have the opportunity to not approve a complaint and send it back to the beginning of the process for reworking. It's just it's all done electronically rather than having to move the paper.
Sir Lantz.
And Mr. Chairman, Ms. Engler, can you, when you're referring to the implied consent revocations or the license revocations, looks like under 169A.50-53, are you talking about transmitting the blood or urine test results from the BCA to the Department of Public Safety so they get the results and can issue a notice of revocation based on that, receiving that information electronically, or is there anything else that's included in that provision?
Ms. Engler.
Mr. Chair, Senator Lantz, my understanding is that as part of the license revocation process, there are some notices that have to be given to the individual who's about to lose their license, and part of the process is then submission of that to Driver and Vehicle Services at the Department of Public Safety. So the system would be used for the transmission of those types of transactions.
Mr. Chairman?
Mr. Lantz, or Senator Lantz.
So does that mean, Ms. Engler, so, for example, if someone's arrested for DWI and they submit to a test at the station so the test results are known right away and the officer determines that it's appropriate to revoke their license, they fill out the notice of revocation, and either if they do it electronically, it's already in a digital form. If they do it by hand, they scan it in, and then they can send that to the Department of Public Safety electronically rather than mailing it in, or the peace officer's certificate that's also part of that process. I mean, often they include the police report. Usually they attach the police report, I understand, to that as well. Is all of that contemplated to be done electronically, then?
Ms. Engler.
Mr. Chair, Senator Lantz, yes.
Ms. Engler, my question is, and I want to follow up on Senator Lantz's question. In reference to apprehending individuals, you had suggested that under this provision that incident data would be on file by a police officer on individuals. And knowing not who he's going to run into in a course of duty, that means that there's going to be a very large database of incident data It's not arrest data. It's not, or it doesn't have to be arrest data. It doesn't have to be prosecution or formal charges. It could be just the record of going to someone's home because there's a neighbor heard some noise in the inside the house emanating from a screen door and called the police. Maybe it's a domestic disturbance of some sort. Didn't lead to anything, didn't lead to any prosecution, but that type of information, incident data, is that on computer police computers now that a police officer could pull up in some database if they happen to pull over a John Smith over on a roadside? Can they look up the data incident on that individual now?
Mr. Chair, setting aside e-charging as a functionality, depending on the officer and the jurisdiction in which they work, they might be able to access some incident data through the mobile devices that they use in their squad cars. My understanding is that it's not uniform across the state and across agencies. Rather, it's how they've chosen to spend their resources. So there may be instances where an officer could access incident data that's held in their records management system in their home agency for use when they interact with someone by the side of the road.
Any other questions? Ms. Engler, one last question. They already collect the data. This bill allows them to disperse it. Is that the purpose of the bill?
Mr. Chair, yes. They law enforcement agencies already collect data. This is basically a transportation mechanism to move that data from place to place.
All right. Any other testimony? Oh, Senator Hall, you have a question.
I'm just checking, Mr. Chair. Is there any opposition to the bill?
We were just going to ask if anyone else wishes to speak. I know that Mr. Neumeister is waiting patiently to extol us with his knowledge. Mr. Neumeister, welcome to the committee.
Going from paper to electronic records does make a difference, does make an impact. If you remember one of your first meetings on data practices, Chairman Limmer talked about the person who wanted something of an electronic record. I believe it was in Maple Grove, and it was hard. But on paper, you would have gotten it or something. I remember that issue. Some of the issues apply here. E-charging is something that your CRIMNET dollars, you, the legislature, appropriated years ago. You are starting to see the fruition of that work. I serve on the Criminal Justice and Information Policy Task Force, which has overseen a lot of the implementation of that money, and e-charging was one of those things. When e-charging, this amendment was done, or this language was done, it was specifically for prosecuting. Now, right now, it's from my angle, it's an experimental stage still, and now it's maybe adult or young adulthood. About 8,000 cases have gone through. With this language, it's going to go from 8,000 to hundreds of thousands of cases. And when you take, one of the concerns I have relate to issues of accountability and transparency. And so with that, I'd like to just share with you a little bit of what some definitions are. Apprehend. Black's Law says seizure in the name of the law. So we're really talking about arrest. When we talk about charging, and if you go back to the language, it's a formal accusation of an offense as a preliminary step. But now we're doing it for arrest. For charge, if you look at to prosecute, it's to commence and, I can't read my own writing, and carry out a legal action to institute and pursue a criminal action against a person. So I have no problems with e-charging, But I look at the accountability and transparency issues that I think it's important for citizens, particularly when a citizen, I'll give some examples, when the citizen says, I would like to have the incident data that Officer Joe did here. And let's say maybe 2 years from now, 3 years, and as you look at the data here, they're looking at 2014 as an implementation statewide. So we're making rules and laws that can affect as this goes progress. So the question is, Officer Joe does an incident report or a call for service. It is being used as it's transmitted for the e-charging, which is more than e-charging now. It could become more of a, you know, transportation, going from arrest to charge to dismiss or whatever. I asked the local level, Officer Joe did this thing, I'd like this information. One of the concerns I have, because of how I've interacted with agencies over the years, I'm sorry, Mr. Neumeister, but you can't get that information, even though it should be public, whatever it might be, in 1382 or somewhere else, depending on what the county attorney, which I haven't had an opportunity to look. It's not public because it's in the e-charging system. Now, when e-charging first came about and discussed several years ago, the transmittal time was only going to be a hold pattern for a couple days or whatever. Now, I don't know how the backlog will increase where all that information will be channeled, you know, how long it will be in the process that BCA does in the backbone. When I asked those questions and other people asked those questions, it was going to be, you know, real quick kind of thing. It was just more for processing. So I don't know how the demand is going to, you know, will there be a time delay for availability of that data. Secondly, if you take a look on page 1, it talks about auditing data. Now, auditing is very important for accountability and also for transparency. When this bill was done, or the law was proposed, and which has been law, was just for charging. Now, when we're dealing with apprehension, arrest, and more of going to an electronic form, there are certain things under the definition of auditing that I would like to see public. Right now, it's considered confidential, and it would be considered private after an inactive investigation happens. So let's say, for example, on auditing, maybe one, who took the particular action? When did the action take place? What action was taken? The purpose for taking the action? Because you've got to remember, the auditing language is not just going to rest with the prosecutors now, which it has been for charging. It's also going to relate to the police agency and other entities that do that. So that's, you want to make sure that as you expand the functionality, and when you go from 8,000 cases to hundreds of thousands or million or whatever it might be, that there's still that accountability and transparency. If you look at the current law, under subdivision 2, it's not on your thing, but if you just look at 299C41, and data classification, it talks about how the data basically is retained as confidentiality. It retains confidentiality as the process, which I have no problem with. It remains private. It also talks about, which is not in here, about how defense counsels can get access to the data and all that. Now, again, that language was done with the prosecutor and charging in mind. But now when you change the functionality, I just think there has to be a revisiting of that language and discuss it a little bit more. So the bill is a good bill. I think it's important to go ahead electronically. There are some savings, but also I believe in accountability and transparency and that we really know how this has happened. Now, I have told you I've served on this task force almost in the past when legislation has gone through, like from an agency like this, it has gone through this task force that I've served on. For 16 years, there's only two people left, me and Ray Schmitz, who used to be Olmsted County Attorney. He's now a citizen, left. Now, I don't know if this bill went through that process because we only meet 4 times a year rather than 12 times a year. So things sometimes get messed up. So, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, it's a great bill, positive bill, But let's just take a look, you know, an above kind of look, and just say, see that the P's and Q's are working right. Mr. Chairman, thank you very much for the few moments of your time.
Thank you, Mr. Neumeister. Mr. Neumeister, I think you've outlived half the legislature in hanging around here. And I think you and I are tied, I think, for who's going to outlast the other. And I'll put the money on you. Any further questions? Ms. Engler, Mr. Neumeister raised questions about whether or not Chapter 13 may be violated as a result of going to electronic collection of data, or for the use of apprehending. That seems to be a concern of at least Senator Latz and Mr. Neumeister in discussion. You had made mention of the application of data privacy laws as it affects this information. Is there anything you may want to add or comment on Mr. Neumeister's concerns?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Couple of things. Contrary to Mr. Neumeister's position, e-charging has always been intended to move information electronically from law enforcement to prosecutors to courts. So adding the incident piece isn't new. It's always been part of the functionality of the system, so that was taken into account when the language was originally drafted and enacted. Secondly, if you look at the definition of auditing data to which you were referred, it specifically references data in e-charging. So this is data related to the electronic part of the transaction. It does not change the classification of the data in the law enforcement agency, who may be, in fact, storing that data electronically in their own computer system. It doesn't change the classification of the data in the hands of the prosecutor. So the language in the e-charging statute is very specifically tailored to the functionality and was enacted to take into account the fact that there would be this aggregation of information in a single place because of the transactions moving through this secure system at the Bureau. So certainly it is the will of the committee whether or not you look at those other provisions, but Chapter 13 still does apply to the data in the hands of the law enforcement agency and in the hands of the prosecutor.
Ms. Engler, data or incident data, is that provided that it's not data that's being used for a criminal investigation, is incident data available to the public?
Mr. Chair, in Section 13.82, and I apologize, I'm not going to do the subdivision off the top of my head, there are some incident data that are always public, regardless of an active criminal investigation, and those data elements are listed in the statute. Just as there are some arrest data that are always public, and there are always some requests for service data that are public.
And so, Ms. Engler, regardless of whether that data is in a paper police file in a local jurisdiction or if it's on record through an e-charging system, if it's available to the public under law, it would also be available through an e-charging system?
Mr. Chair, I'm not sure that I think the way that the language is written in 299C41 makes the data that are housed at the Bureau in the e-charging system not accessible to the public. Rather, the public access would have to occur at the local law enforcement agency or the prosecuting office.
Okay, thank you. Senator Latz.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chairman. That last point was something I think I remember from my service in the House years ago when these topics came through the process. And there was a big discussion about accessibility at that point. In fact, I think Representative Holberg was very concerned at that time about the inability to get certain information out of some parts of the system, even when it was relating to her. but I can understand why you'd want the originator of the data or the party that has the main control over the content of the data rather than just the warehouse or the storage facility for the data to be the one that controls the access under Chapter 13. I can understand that, even if it might cause certain delays in getting access to the data. And I suppose, I don't know Chapter 13, chapter and verse, but I suppose the form in which the data is stored is less important as long as it's covered, whether it's electronic or paper form, as long as it's the type of data that I think Chapter 13 would apply to. But I do have a couple of concerns I'd like to inquire about. One is Mr. Newmaster brought up the sort of the concern about the time delay because of the time it may take for data to be transmitted from one location to another. And I don't know if that's the same as not being able to access it through the warehouse of the data at the BCA. But I suppose there ought to be, if there's going to be a lot more volume of data, you probably have to make sure the electronic pipeline is big enough to accommodate the transmission of data so it doesn't get stuck somewhere. And that's more of a technical question and more of a comment, really. Certainly issues of data security would be paramount, not specifically addressed here, but I'm sure the technical folks in the system are aware of it. But the more data you've got flowing through these pipelines in different places, the more you need to be concerned about data security, unauthorized access to by hackers or others. I think there's possibly some concern about whether e-charging is still an appropriate term. If this goes beyond charging to all these other things, transparency may dictate that a new, more accurately descriptive term be utilized, and one that is less presumptive, because if now we're talking about incident data that may or may not lead or even be part of a particular charging process, calling it e-charging carries some at least public innuendo or presumptions, if you will, about what the data's existence or purpose is for beyond what it might be with the broader definition now of the data. And so I wonder if the parties could give some thought to a different term that might be more accurate and less presumptive. Then I wonder also about the questions Mr. Newmeister raised about the auditing data definitions or list, and whether or not with the expanded definition of the coverage of the statute, whether there might be a need to add to the list of auditing data or redefine some of the auditing data to make sure that new uses are accurately trackable for public accountability purposes. And I guess maybe I'm better at asking questions now than having answers to some of these, which I suppose is one reason we have a task force that specializes in looking at some of these things as well. So I guess one question would be one of urgency, if any, relating to these changes. And number two, whether or not there's an opportunity before we take any action, because I think all of these issues would be within the jurisdiction of this committee, to get perhaps some input from those more expert in these things than I am or we are, to see if more changes than just the expansion of the definition of e-charging are appropriate.
Is there a question in there, Senator?
Well, maybe for all the committee. Yeah, I mean, should we have the task force, for example, take a look at this before we act on it, and give us some feedback and input as to whether more should be done to protect it? I think I'd like an answer to the or a solution to the terminology question also before it moves beyond this committee.
Senator Latz, you're beginning to act more and more like a member of the Data Privacy Subcommittee.
Oh, no.
Very discussion and questions that we would endlessly get into. And we could make you an honorary cult member.
I don't think I've drunk the Kool-Aid yet, Mr. Chair.
Senator Jungbauer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I'm afraid to ask my questions or get onto that subject. I don't want to be a cult member, I guess. But I agree with Senator Latz. I think in terms of the overall name, to call it the e-charging system is presumptive, and I would think that just the name of the platform ought to be able to be changed fairly simply without veering off of what we're actually accomplishing here as we're expanding that. I'm all in favor of doing this electronically. I'm all in favor of saving money, and we're looking for those kind of ways to transmit and not have to re-enter all that data, because so many times names or something gets re-entered wrong, and of course that affects the outcome of court cases and things as well. So I do think this committee ought to look at or get answers, Ms. Engler, on whether we can change the name without big process. But my second thing is when we're talking about auditing, I was thinking when we talk about internet protocol address, and I don't know if that's always going to be accurate as we're transmitting these things across different bandwidths. And having just been at a convention where we talked about some of the public safety bandwidth and the different ways that we're different platforms we're going to be transmitting this data in the future, you know, some of it's here today, but in the very near future, I don't know if we have an IP address always with that, or if we need to add a few things in here based on the new platforms we're using in order to overcome that clogging of the system. We're adding and expanding things on bandwidth in order to be able to transmit that data very quickly. So I want to make sure that we have all the definitions in here, that if we're using some other system and we're able to authenticate the transmission and it comes off as something different, that we need that type of the technical terms in here, so we're not, again, losing something and the court says, well, we're on a different platform, this isn't accurate, this doesn't, and we, you know, let somebody go because of some technicality. So that were my only two things, but I think the e-charging thing is a big deal to call it e-charging if we're expanding the operational aspects of that. So I don't know if you have an easy answer on changing that name to e something. Yep. E-file transmission, e.
I get real nervous, members, when we start changing the name of a platform because it's, as you can tell, it's found elsewhere in statute. And so we probably have to change a few things. Senator Newman's bill is a bill that was brought to us by the administration to define better how the e-charging system is applied. So we're kind of following a governor's agency head that wants to have a little more flexibility with the statute.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Newman.
Members, I will certainly, go along with whatever the committee wishes here, and, what Senator Latz and Senator Jungbauer has brought up, a lot of different points, but candidly, I haven't really heard a question yet, just observations and thoughts that might be more appropriate for the committee that Mr. Neumeister sits on. I think it's really up to the committee at this point as to whether or not you want to go forward with this, with in effect is what the governor's request. I don't know that in this setting we can address all of the different issues that have been brought forward or questioned. And I also, as to whether we're going to change this from e-charging to something else, I think the chairman has brought up a very good point. We're liable to delve into some other statutes already existing that we don't want to get involved in. So, at this point, I guess my thought would be to move forward with the bill if there are specific requests or amendments that any of the members have that you want to bring up between now and when we hear it on the floor. That would be fine. I would certainly entertain it. This is something that is really a committee bill, and I will do what the members wish to do.
Senator Newman recommends Senate File 881 to be recommended to pass and move to the floor. Any further discussion? Senator Lyons?
Mr. Chairman, I think I'm going to support that motion, but I think we as a committee also can send this over to the task force and ask them to take a look at it and make some recommendations back to us at some point, sooner rather than later, as to whether any changes ought to be made, including name and the other kind of questions that we've pondered here, even though we don't have specific answers. I don't think any of the questions ought to hold this up, but I do think that they're worth getting some answers to.
All right. Thank you. The motion remains in front of us. Hearing no further discussion, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you, Senator Newman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
All the questions seem to be coming from two members. We have to move you guys to the opposite ends of the table, I think.
Just point them to subcommittee.
Or they could be a member of the Data Privacy Subcommittee.
Subcommittee.
You're in trouble now, John.
That's it. Senator Newman, I'm going to have you chair while we do the revised.
I'm on my way, Mr. Chairman.
I got nothing.
Senator Limmer, to begin with, we are dealing with Senate File 885. It's my understanding you have an amendment. Do you wish to proceed first with your amendment?
Yes, I do, Mr.
Chair. Okay.
I'd like to introduce the A2 amendment as an author's amendment.
Okay. Senator Limmer offers the A2 amendment as an author's amendment. Is there any discussion?
Well, Mr. Chair, just so everyone knows what this is about, I'm going to have Kathy Pontius.
That's fine. Ms. Pontius.
Mr. Chairman and members, you know, this is the statutory cleanup bill. And the first section that's in the amendment is actually one that I identified. I got a call from an attorney about 6 weeks ago who was doing a probate case, and he said, you know, there's a reference to a statute that has been repealed. And so I sort of tracked down the history and found out where the new language ended up. And this is just a general provision under the law that directs the Supreme Court to adopt rules of civil procedure. So it strikes a repealed statute and replaces it with the new statute that was enacted to replace the repealed statute in 2006. And then the second section, I think Ms. Rahm from the Revisor's Office or Ms. Timmons can address too. This was originally the bill repealed this provision. It's an alternative dispute arbitration law that applies to planning disputes among government entities. And if you look at the stricken language on lines 23 to 25, under current law, the panel is supposed to consider goals stated in Section 4A.08. Well, that section of law no longer exists. And instead of actually repealing the whole provision, though, I think it came to the Revisor's Office attention that this language is still necessary because it does lay out some factors. So under the amendment, instead of repealing the subdivision 5, it just strikes the references in the beginning to the repealed statute, but still keeps the factors in the law.
Anything further you wish to add, Senator Limmer?
I'll renew my motion, Mr. Chair.
Any questions or comments by any of the members? If not, all those in favor of the A2 amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. All those opposed, nay. The motion passes. The amendment is adopted. Senator Limmer, to your bill.
Yeah, Mr. Chair and members, this bill, Senate File 885, is referred to as the Revisor's Bill. It's an annual event that we do in the legislature. It is always under the jurisdiction of the Judiciary Committee. For the benefit of our new members, we have a Revisor's Bill usually in the first part of the session. Then we have a Corrections Bill that corrects as much as we know for lack of a better term, perhaps the misaccounting of statute as it passes through the legislature, and we want to make sure that it's done to the intent, the legislative intent of the legislature. This is a revisor's bill. It corrects references under law that somehow we've missed, and it's a whole hodgepodge collection of references like that. It is not supposed to have anything substantive in it, but other than to correct either grammatical errors, references to other statutes, or references of law. And from this point, I'm going to hand off to one of our revisor staff, and she can get into the deep weeds of this particular bill.
Ms. Timmons, please identify yourself for the record and proceed.
Certainly will. For the record, I'm Michelle Timmons, the revisor of statutes. Mr. Chair and members, thank you, Senator Limmer, for that summary. This is the annual revisor's bill, not to be confused with the annual corrections bill that we'll take up later in the session to correct errors that occur in this session. These are errors that have been found in past sessions of legislative work. And one of the questions I received in testifying in front of the Senate State Government Committee was, well, what do you do during the interim when the members are not in session and the legislature is no longer in session? Well, there are 24,000 pages of statutes. There are 15,000 pages of administrative rules, and usually each session the legislature passes 4,000 to 6,000 pages of new law. And so the first order of business is to edit and index and publish all the new law that you pass. And then the next order of business is to merge all that new law in with that existing body of statutes. And when we work on that editing and publishing task of the statutes, that is often when we discover errors. And so this bill has four articles. Article 1 is a number of miscellaneous errors. They're mostly cross-references to the wrong statute. But there are also typographical errors. As we're doing our editing, we find things that aren't grammatically correct that we wish to fix. We also have been doing a project to try to improve some citations to federal law that we have in the Minnesota statute. So there are a few of those corrections in Article 1. Also, we are reviving some administrative rules that were inadvertently repealed, and we're also resolving editorial conflicts that we found during the interim. Sometimes the legislature makes two or three amendments to the same section of law, and they don't always fit. And so then what we do is we follow Minnesota Statute 645.33, and we publish the amendment that was the latest enacted, and then we'll show earlier enacted ones as notes. And what we ask to do in the revisor's bill is to be able to resolve those conflicts. So that's Article 1 is that miscellaneous grouping of errors. Article 2 relates to data practices, and about a decade ago, we started a project in which in Chapter 13, we create sections that cross-reference to data practices provisions codified elsewhere in the statutes. And so most of the time now when the legislature makes a change in a data practices provision, there is a corresponding change right in Chapter 13 to cross-reference that new provision if it's not codified in Chapter 13 from the get-go. But sometimes we miss some of those. So Article 2 creates a number of those cross-references to try to be complete within Chapter 13. Article 3 relates to the fact that the Minnesota Supreme Court made some changes in rules of criminal procedure, and those rules of criminal procedure are cross-referenced in some of the statutes. So we're just making changes to be consistent with what the Minnesota Supreme Court did. And then Article 4, the final article of the bill, relates to community-based planning. There were goals of community-based planning that were repealed in 1999, and then in 2009, the Office of Strategic and Long-Range Planning was abolished. And so one of the things we did during this past interim is to try to do a project to clean up the statutes and make changes to reflect those two actions taken by the legislature. And we worked with the Department of Administration to make sure that the executive branch was okay with those proposed changes. So with that summary, that's a summary of what's in the bill, and I would answer any questions.
Anything further you want to wish to add, Senator Limmer? Any questions or comments by committee members? Senator Marty.
Mr. Chairman, Ms. Timmons, on the bottom of page 42, where you had the, where in statute we put in a long web address, I think the fact that there was an error in that long address would be enough of an error, somebody who reads that trying to type it in anyway, but I think we should just keep that in mind for future reference when people put web pages in the statute, that maybe a more general statute, a more general web page rather than the precise search area might be helpful. I did have one question. I can see how, like in Section 20, where the law said that person who unlawfully possesses small amount of marijuana is guilty of a petty misdemeanor.
Senator Marty, what page are you on?
Page 14. I mean, it looks kind of silly when you see it now that the person who possesses a small amount of marijuana is guilty not only of a petty misdemeanor, but also guilty of participation in a drug education program. I can see why you corrected that. But when you get to something like on page 25, the permanency hearings, if the child has been in placement 15 days of the last 22 months, and you wanted to read 15 months of the last 22 months in effect, do you, when you find something like that, I don't know enough about this to know whether, I'm assuming you've checked it out, but is that something where you check with the people who put the law in place, or because it could read fine 15 days of the last 22 months, another very short period in a foster care. But do you check with it? How do you know that that's the intent, what it was?
Ms. Timmons.
Senator Marty, Mr. Chairman and members, we look at a number of things. For example, if you look, first of all, we look at context. So, for example, if you look at line 25.3, okay. You can see that in that context, it's clear the language there is when the child has been in placement 15 of the last 22 months. So some of the issues we find when we're really doing close editing, and we find that in context, something is out of place. So in this case, it appears that 15 of the last 22 months is the concept that is really in the statute, not 15 days of the last 22 months. In addition, what we do is we do typically check with the department that is involved, especially if we have any doubt about it. And also, many times mistakes are found by other folks in the agencies, Senate Council, House Research. So mistakes come to our attention in a variety of ways.
Any further comments or questions from the committee? If not, Senator Lemmer renews your motion is to
Senator,
to go to the floor.
Or, Mr. Chair, I move that Senate File Number 885 be recommended to pass and move to the floor.
Mr. Chairman,
Senator Lemmer,
shouldn't we inquire whether there's any opposition to this bill?
No.
Senator Latz, I was hoping you weren't going to ask that question. Is there any opposition to this bill? Seeing none. All those in favor of... I'm sorry.
Senator Mr. Chairman, Martin, I just wonder if this might be consent calendar item.
You know, Senator Martin, Lemmer. I don't remember it ever being on a consent bill. I think
I
we'll...
this one had...
I know that all my bills should be on the consent bill, but I
think yours should be.
Senator Lemmer, there's a couple of members that are nodding their head yes. I at your pleasure, Senator Lemmer.
Let's just
Senator Ortman.
Mr. Chair, we can make anything controversial if we want to.
Senator Lemmer.
I think we'll just go right to the floor and we'll deal with it there.
Okay. Senator Lemmer renews his motion. I see no further discussion. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 All those opposed, no. The motion passes. Anything further?
Mr. Chair, there's no further business before the committee, and I recommend you adjourn.
Okay. There being no further business before the committee, we stand adjourned.
Until when? Do you know?